Amazing. Thank you guys all for coming to this panel today. I'm really excited to dive into this conversation, which I hope will be helpful for all of us journalists here. My name is Benji. I'm an environmental reporter at Vox, and I honestly kind of selfishly wanted to host this panel because I want help addressing a problem that I face in my work, which is that I find it really difficult at times to get our audience, which is very broad, interested in places, animals, plants, ecosystems that are not typically charismatic. And I'm thinking about species like, I don't know, kinds of freshwater mussels, which are incredible creatures, but people don't care that much, even though we depend on a lot of the services they provide. I'm thinking about native bees, not the honeybees that everyone is caring about so much. Native bees are the ones that really need our support. Conchs, I love conchs. I mean, obviously, I can go on and on, but I'd rather hear from our panelists who are going to help us, try to understand how we can better engage our readers in animals and plants and places that are not so traditionally charismatic. So I'll introduce them now. Bethany Brookshire. She's an award-winning freelance science journalist and author of the 2020 book Pests: How Humans Create Animal Villains. She writes about human-animal conflict, ecology, neuroscience, and other topics. Her work has appeared in Science, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and a bunch of other outlets. And impressively, she also has a PhD in physiology and pharmacology. Welcome, Bethany. We also have Maya Kapoor. She's an award-winning journalist who's reported extensively on the Southwest and U.S.-Mexico borderlands. These days, she writes about climate change, biodiversity, and environmental justice. She also just told me she has an MFA in creative writing and a master's in ecology. In her previous career, she was a field biologist, and she's currently an engagement manager at Covering Climate Now. And finally, we have Doug Name, who is a freelance journalist covering the environment, science, and obscure animals and plants. How fitting. His work appears in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Scientific American, and elsewhere. He recently spent several years as a senior writer and editor on staff with National Geographic, which obviously is a huge audience, where he wrote about things like moth-eating grizzlies in Montana, exotic wildlife ranches in Texas, and the environmental consequences of the border wall. Thank you guys all so much for being here. I'm so happy to have you. And I'll just say we'll have plenty of time for questions at the end, so please hold on to those. And we'll the SEJ policy is to prioritize journalists asking those questions. So before getting into the conversation today, I want to have each of you share a short story about an obscure plant or animal that you were drawn to, just to give us a sense of what kinds of things we'll be talking about today. Bethany, why don't we start with you? Share your weird animal story.
Can y'all hear me okay? Ooh, all right. Hi. There's two options. Neither are necessarily what you would call obscure in the traditional sense. I will take a vote. Your two options are pigeons or ponies. Please raise your hand for pigeons. Please raise your hand for ponies. These are my people. I appreciate this. So I became fascinated by pigeons when I was writing my book, Pests, which is about animals that we hate and why we hate them. And I was particularly struck by the fall of the pigeon from grace, because when people think of pigeons, city streets and New York in particular, and London sometimes, Venice is another big one, just coated in pigeons and pigeon poo, and people call them rats with wings, and all this kind of stuff. And I was really struck because I was reading a lot of research. There's a wonderful researcher named Colin Jaromack who wrote his dissertation on the fall of the pigeon in public spaces by tracking 100 years of pigeon coverage in the New York Times.
Oh,
Heroic is what that was. And he watched the pigeon fall from grace from about the 1880s, when it was described as beautiful and innocent and sweet. And then it became rats with wings in 1966. So it was really fascinating to watch that happen. And one of the things that I found most fascinating about writing about pigeons is the fact that the reason they fell from grace was due to literally nothing the pigeons did. It was due to everything the humans did. Humans loved pigeons from about 4,000 years before present or more, 6,000, give it 6,000, until about 100 years ago. And it was because of the services we got from them. They were fertilizer. Their poo was fertilizer. There's wonderful dovecotes that you can find in the area that was ancient Persia that are designed like these like really gorgeous funnels, so that when the pigeons poop, it just goes, and then you can just take a shovel. It's great. It's like a compost heap, except way worse. And we loved them for that. We loved them because they were messengers. Some of you may be aware that the modern pigeon, racing pigeon, helped found the Wire News Service. It was Reuters who flew pigeons back and forth from, I think it was Belgium, it was Brussels to Antwerp with hot stock tips. He could beat the train by 2 hours with his pigeons. And of course, we ate them. And I don't know if anybody has had squab. It's delicious, actually. And what I found fascinating was we had all these uses for the pigeon until we didn't. The pigeon is the outdated iPhone of the animal world. The kind of thing that you see on a city street or discover in a drawer and go, oh, God, how did I ever live when I had that thing? Right? We don't need pigeon messengers anymore. We have the internet. We don't need pigeon fertilizer anymore. We have chemical fertilizer. And we don't need squab because we have chicken. That is, in fact, the reason for the decline of squab, was the rise of the chicken in the 1950s. And I just found it fascinating how much our perception of this animal was filtered through our desires and our needs, what we wanted and what we needed. And when we don't need that animal anymore, how it goes so quickly from this beautiful, innocent, charming bird that Darwin wanted to write an entire book about to a rat with wings.
Pigeons are the original journalists, is my takeaway. How about you, Doug? I know this is going to be a very
awesome.
Yeah, pigeons were the original internet. That's amazing. Yeah, so my story is about the Osage orange tree. So the Osage orange tree has this amazing fruit. It's like softball size, bright green. They're called hedge apples. Raise your hand if you've heard of this or seen this. Okay, so that counts as obscure then. So I had seen this plant growing up in Illinois a little bit and been curious about it, especially as a child, like the fun to throw around. It is the largest fruit native to North America. And then I forgot about it and did some other things for the next 15 years. I was working in Nat Geo in Washington, D.C., and it was shortly after the pandemic. I was walking through Montrose Park in Georgetown, and there were hedge apples all over the place. And I just kind of like, I remembered my childhood interests, and I was doing some research on them. And it turns out this is an amazing, amazing story hiding in plain sight. I'll tell you some of the cool things really briefly, but basically, to start with, like, why is this fruit so big? Basically, no animal that's around now efficiently distributes its seed. Like squirrels will nibble on it, but the question is, from an evolutionary point of view, like why would the plant put that much energy into a huge fruit? So the theory is that that this tree co-evolved with the now extinct giant animal, like probably a ground sloth, maybe a mastodon, and there were, as you may or may not know, like before, until about 13,000 years ago, there were all kinds of crazy megafauna. Like there were dozens of ground sloths throughout the Americas. And after the last ice age, the range of the Osage orange shrunk a lot too, which I think could be due to the loss of this tree's seed spreader. Then there's also the human interaction side. Like this tree helped settle America. Like in the 1850s, most of the hedgerows, like in the Midwest and Great Plains, were Osage orange. There were, by 1870, there were 60,000 miles of Osage orange hedgerows. And like, so when it's planted close together, it forms these really tight hedgerows that were in parlance of the times, horse high, hog tight, and bull strong. So it helps farmers keep animals in or from getting in. And it was also, even before then, so the Osage people for whom it's named, they made archery bows out of this tree. It is like of any plant in the world has the strongest and most flexible wood. So it is the best archery bow material. Bow dark is French for archery bow. And that's where the name of the Ozarks comes from too. But yeah, like in the early 1800s, it would cost you a horse and a blanket to get one of these archery bows. And yeah, I mean, I'll leave it there. There's some other cool aspects of it. It burns hotter than any other wood. It has the highest BTU value. When I did the story, I mean, I thought it was cool. It's kind of this, you know, the story hiding in plain sight, but the reaction I got from it was kind of, I was really surprised. I got more like response from this story than almost anything I've done. And I think, so the reason I bring it up is that it was just an illustration to me that, like, you know, following your curiosity can really pay off. And I mean, as journalists, we love to break news and I like to do investigative stuff. But I think also just kind of following your curiosity to a place, to an unexpected place, is also that is not necessarily like newsworthy or like a breaking news situation. It's still a very viable model and important thing for. And that's what this panel is all about.
Yeah, exactly. I really love that. And just like the fact that you can be walking around and all around you, there could be stories behind the plants on your street or whatever, if you just kind of open your eyes and take the time to learn about it. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. What about you, Maya?
Hey, can you hear me okay? Thank you so much for having us for this panel. This is great. So I was going to talk a little bit about a story I wrote for Grist last year about the American chestnut tree and efforts to bring it back from extinction using genetic engineering. And the story has been told before, but I looked at it through an Indigenous Affairs lens. And something I really enjoyed about covering the story was that I think that the non-human species are interesting because, you know, they exist on their own outside of us and are their own things, but they also are parts of our stories. And the stories that we tell about non-human species are really stories that we're telling about ourselves. And so in this example, a lot of people have covered the American chestnut trees extinction due to an introduced pathogen that came in on European chestnut trees that were brought in by arborists. And then efforts since then over the past century to bring the tree back and to have it be a wild species again, because at one time it was one of the predominant trees of the Eastern Seaboard. But in the story, you know, the fact is, when you look at the history of the American chestnut tree, it began in like the Southern Appalachians during the last ice age. There was a mammoth refugium there for this tree, and then it spread up the East Coast in many ways, thanks to like agroforestry or ethnoforestry. And people moved the species, created groves of these chestnut trees, and a lot of the writing and literature and communications around bringing back the chestnut tree has been about reestablishing sort of an unsullied wilderness. But when you actually know the history of this tree, it was very much managed by people before Europeans arrived on this continent. And so to me, the storytelling about the chestnut tree has been interesting because it's a storytelling about what people believe about the history of this country and this continent. So when I covered it, other people have covered it as well, but I really dug into like past and current laws around stewardship and land use and land ownership. So the question is, if the species is successfully brought back through genetic engineering, where those relationships with the plant exist to like to create these orchards again and to steward it in the same way when so many of those socio-ecological systems are prevented through like our current legal system. So to me, writing about the non-charismatic or interesting but kind of obscure plant or animal is a way to write about how we as a country or as a culture think about those relationships and how we moderate them.
Big showings for plants. I love it. And I also just think like the common thread through all three of these examples is just like the relationship with humans and the animals, like thinking about them in the context of human lives. And I think that's a lesson that we'll maybe come to later. So I first want to talk about like the story selection and pitching process. And you kind of all touched on this a little bit, but I want to hear just about what makes a particular place or species worthy of a story in your eyes when it's not classically charismatic. Like, before sitting down to pitch to an editor, for example, what do you look for to know whether a certain story, a certain animal is compelling enough for a story? And maybe starting with either Bethany or Maya.
Well, I just want to say, I was actually rereading your story on the American chestnut and how much I loved the way you described the disease of the chestnut was really beautiful because it really made it seem like a sick person. And kind of the way you described, I think it was like weeping tumors. And I was like, whoa. It was great. I have a tough time with pitching because to me, all stories are awesome. And so the problem that I have, I often do try to find the human angle on it. Just because, I mean, the reality is we're deeply self-centered species. We really, really care about what the world has done for us lately, right? So if you can't find kind of that human angle, you can sometimes find a human who cares about it in a really, really deep way. Or like a community that really depends upon that thing, even if they don't know that they depend on it. Often I go through very much most of my reporting is through the human lens, because of course the way that we perceive the world is deeply subjective and we don't see it that way. Right? We think that the way we see the world is the way that things are, but that's just not the case. And so I really do often try to find the human angle, which kind of feels like a cop out, but there we are.
What was the process of like pitching your book past? Like, where did the idea come from? Was it difficult to get people interested in it? Or is it because we're all familiar with the pigeon, for example, that there was a media appeal?
That's the thing is the actual impetus for it was like the most unsexy part of the book. I am obsessed with the origins of house mice in the Levant, which took place around 14,000 years ago. They're great. Nobody appreciates them. But I became obsessed with, again, the human angle on it. We have had house mice literally since we had houses. That was the origin of the house mouse, was the very first semi-permanent human settlement. Acquired mice that were less afraid than other mice. And then natural selection took over, and here we are. And that was really just the huge impetus to me and made me very obsessed. But I'm pretty sure that the book actually sold due to rats and pigeons and cats in particular, as opposed to the mice, even though I personally love the mice.
What about you, Maya? Like, what are some of the green flags that come up when you're researching for stories?
I think that to me, the fact that something is obscure makes it like easier to pitch in some ways because it's a story that hasn't been told before, but I'm definitely careful about pre-reporting. And if I find a story about, like I was going to pitch a story about a kind of obscure species of cactus based on some academic research that came out about it, but I dug around a little bit and realized like, this isn't really, like it's a very, it's just like one little piece of research that's pretty minor and it's not, it would be cool to have a reason to write about this random cactus, but like this isn't it. And I also, I try to think in terms of like, species story, but then the human story that or time period that you can play to that. So I wrote a feature about a really rare species of catfish that is the only catfish that's native to the Western U.S. And originally I found a statistical analysis that basically said, you know, it's going to go extinct pretty fast and there are maybe like 30 of them left in the U.S. And so that could have been a short explainer about a thing most people don't know, which is that there is a catfish species that's native to Arizona and Sonora, Mexico, and that it's about to go extinct. But then when I talked to the researchers about it in like a pre-recording stage, they mentioned that they were going to go to Mexico to look for more. And so then there was a reason to start building out a potential feature pitch based on this travel and this question of would they find it or not. So to me, the obscurity actually is a peg itself and not a barrier.
Yeah, I love that. Also, like, you have the stakes. It's, like, potentially going to go extinct, and you also have, like, the broader meaning because you see the decline of water in the Southwest, for example, which I think are both essential. Doug, you've obviously spent a lot of time as an editor. When you get pitches from freelancers or when you're thinking about assigning or when you did get pitches from freelancers thinking about assigning stories, like, what were some of the things that you would look out for to be like, okay, our audience will like this, even though it's not necessarily an animal or plant that they're thinking about every day or have any experience with or will ever see? And then what are some of the things that you were like, okay, we can't take this because of whatever reason?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Maya that something being obscure can actually be a help because people always want to learn new things and they want to be surprised. So things I looked for and I mean, a useful thing about editing is also, I think it helps you to pitch because then you know what it's like on the other side. But so it goes both ways. But yeah, so I would say I looked for like something that surprised me or that was like the superlatives really help, you know. Unfortunately, it's hard to do stories about like shrubs or like I don't know grass, you know, like I would love to do that.
I mean, so I have a grass story that I really
yeah, right, you know what I mean though, like carnivorous plants are easier than grass. I just did a story for the New York Times and does not directly answer your question, but it was about this fern that grows roots from its dying fronds. And like no one had ever found senescing dying tissue turning into another tissue. It's crazy. So like, basically just like surprising things, often based on studies, but not necessarily. I think it's really just about surprise and it being like situated in a place, and also like if it can help tell a larger story, that's really helpful. You know, like. I'm thinking of it was sort of about ice worms, which are these worms that live in glaciers. They're really cool because they can thrive at freezing temperature. Like there's almost no mammals that can do this. They're going extinct now, or they're threatened with extinction because glaciers are disappearing. And so like through this little weird worm, you can talk about like the loss of glaciers and climate change. And so also basically having a hook into like a larger global or, you know, regional global story that really helps.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. And when you talk about superlatives, meaning like the largest fish in the world, like those kinds of things.
Sure. Yes. Superlatives or just findings that new findings, something that changes like our thinking about how things work, which we're constantly finding.
Right.
It's something that doesn't work. At Nat Geo, and anywhere, but especially Nat Geo, they have very high standards visually. And there were some stories I wanted to do where like if we didn't have photos we just couldn't do it, and that was kind of sad to be in that place. And if it was up to me, I would do it anyway and like find an illustrator or something, but like, you know, that's you don't get to do that all the time. So but I would say visuals can be hard, and also like sometimes, I mean, this is kind of contradicting what I was saying about like following curiosity, but if something doesn't have if there's not an obvious reason to do it now, it can be harder. You know what I mean? Like you need to make a case as to why the story should be told now. And that can be something easy, like there's a study coming out. But sometimes you need to think more creatively if it's not like some easy thing like that.
Right.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think you need to know what the stakes are.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And then just building on this, like we all get probably similar press releases from different scientific publications. We're seeing the same studies. You've talked in some ways about this already, but like, what are some of the, like, when you're, what are your lenses that we are looking through when you're looking at all those press, like the little abstracts or blurbs about the studies, things that like really stand out to you when you're reading through just like all of those blurbs, trying to figure out if there's something worth covering? Does anything come to mind?
I would say, you know, a lot of single studies, I'm mostly interested in them if they reveal something bigger about the world. And like in the case of plants, maybe it's a cool new way that a plant propagates, because plants will just, they will blow your mind every time. You know, with, you know, animals, maybe it's a wider story of kind of, you know, how the brown rat kind of followed the course of manifest destiny. You can take these kind of small single studies and use them to illuminate larger ideas, ways of thinking, and also kind of ways that humans have perceived the world. And that's kind of what I'm looking for when I'm looking at single studies.
Do you guys have anything to
add? I was just going to say that I try to be really careful to first, you know, if I am looking through a particular journal I'm interested in, or looking at, you know, a round of press releases about studies, to be really careful to make sure that the presser isn't overselling the findings, and that, you know, if there's something that catches my mind that I look into to make sure that those bigger stakes are there, but also you know, understanding the scientific process and the academy, there's so much pressure to be publishing and to have new studies, and so is the study true, or is it just sort of like a turn of the screw? And just taking the time to do that work on the front end. And also, once you have sources who are researchers, or perhaps even people in conservation, if that's something you're interested in, you can check in with them once in a while and say, hey, do you have any new work coming out? Or is there any research you might like that I should be paying attention to? So there's, you know, definitely those kinds of like resources as well. Yeah,
totally. And I also just think about the, like, a tip is just to, if you do have some, like, I mean, we probably all do, but like scientific sources, like researchers running new studies by them too, just to get their sense of whether this is something really new, like not the author themselves, but someone else that could give you that perspective, I think can be really helpful.
I would also just say, like, I think of a press release as merely the thing that makes you click on the actual paper. Mm-hmm. I rarely read them, honestly. It's all about, like, where's the paper? Just give me the link.
Right.
I also like to just say that I also think of scientific studies as one angle into stories about species, but, you know, that's, like, one worldview and one lens. And so it's important to also ask yourself, like, what histories am I missing, or what voices am I missing, and what other routes can I find to find these stories that doesn't solely rely on this one institutional process or this one lens?
Really, like, that's really, really important. So once, like, we just talked about story selection and pitching, when we sit down to write, like, one of the things I find myself doing very often is, like, I'll be writing about a species and I'll, like, put the same paragraph in every story about, like, how it's a linchpin in the ecosystem, and if we lose it, then we lose the services. And, like, that phrasing is, like, it's obviously true. It's literally true for every species, but I often find myself just kind of, like, sighing every time I write that, because it feels just, like, rote and not necessarily, like, what is going to get people to care. Like, I don't know how many people do necessarily care about, like, the services that sustain us. So I guess I want to hear more from all of you just about the ways when you're actually sitting down to write that you try to draw people into your stories when the topic is not something that is already on people's mind. So I think, like, when you were talking about the human element, that seems like a really good piece of advice. But if there are other ways that you think about framing the story, like, I don't know, writing about the role that a particular species plays in the ecosystem, how we relate to it. Like, I'd love to just hear, advice that you have for pulling people in that are not already engaged.
I'll take a stab at that. That's something I wrestle with a lot, justifying, you know, why you're writing about it. Sometimes it feels kind of forced. Like,
like it's almost like you have to like convince the editor to do it. And I'm not sure, I don't think the reader necessarily cares as much as the editor sometimes, you know what I mean? It's kind of weird. It's almost like in press releases, I think you see this even more in press releases because the PIO or whatever is trying to, and this is no offense or anything, I'm just saying it seems like they're trying to sell the research more, like this is why it's important, and almost like a cousin of a grant application or something. But yeah, so I mean, I think it's important, but maybe not as important as editors sometimes. I'm not like bad mouthing editors in the audience, but like I think either you're interested or you're not. It's important to educate people though, also for sure. And I think that's an important. I think we'd all agree that's like an important role. But to a certain extent, people either will be interested or not. But yeah, like I think it's often easy and good to say, but if it can feel tiring. Like if you do a story about pollinators, you know, you point out like all of our, I mean, not all of our food, but the vast majority of our vegetables, like we need pollinators, right? Like that's why you're eating a story about bees, and that's why they're cool. But you know, I think anyone who reads about this or cares about this stuff enough where it's obvious that you know, research and inquiry are like good in and of themselves, and they always lead to unexpected cool things. Like in the case of the ice worm, the ice worm thrives at, like I said, freezing temperature, and the scientists were wondering like how do they do that, and it turns out that their ATP synthase, which is an enzyme that produces ATP, it's like the cellular currency of energy. Every living thing needs it. It has like a slight alteration that makes it more efficient, and like that's crazy. It's really rare because ATP synthase is very, very highly conserved amongst every living thing. And it's also extremely efficient. It's like 99% efficient, I think. Someone can fact check me on that, but that's like unheard of for many natural things. And so, you know, maybe that could have some crazy application in the future. We don't know. And so, yeah, I mean, like a lot of drugs have been discovered from plants and we weren't even looking for that. But so that's a long-winded answer.
So like tying it into, again, like bigger things, you're talking about like the incredible biology, potential applications, like those things are very important to mention in the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you guys? Do you have anything to add?
I often try to flip perspective, right? The name of the philosopher is escaping me now, which is terrible because, oh my goodness, I spent so much time reading this guy. There's a famous French philosopher who did an entire way too long essay about how his cat sees him naked. Honest. And it had a point. It did. I'm not sure I got the point, but it had one. But the fact is that it makes you look at it and go, no. Every time you get dressed, your cat is like, oh my God, why don't you put your fur on? And it makes you realize you can do this for other species, right? Like, you know, a centipede looking at a human being like, oh, so few legs, that's disgusting. And so you can call out the differences and flip the perspective by saying, like, you know, to a centipede, you are gross. But you can also kind of use a similar perspective, right? Like Sicilians make milk. We all have the capability of doing that anatomically. So, I mean, you know, that's something that we have in common. So you can kind of either flip the perspective to call out the differences, or you can bring them in by saying, this animal is not as unlike you as you think it is. Or this plant, not as unlike as you think it is.
Right.
And I find both of those can really make people go, oh, okay.
I love that. I love the sun and pizza.
I did not go to journalism school. I have an MFA in creative nonfiction. And so when I was learning to be a better writer, my audience was other students who were, for the most part, not interested in science. And the learning them was. And that was great for me because I wanted to work to find a reason for someone to care about what I was writing other than they already care about whatever it is I'm writing about. And so that's where I think your craft really comes in,
interesting story, if you have interesting characters, if you have active, powerful verbs and cool scenes, people will read your story about the history of rubber bands. Like, they, you know, it doesn't have to be an argument that you're making. Unless your job actually is, like, you do comms for an organization that is working to protect certain organisms, then that is your job, and you are making an argument. But as a journalist, it's not necessarily your job, and you may have a story to tell about pollinators, like, really pollinators to survive, the SNATOs, and that's important information for your audience to know. But in terms of getting them to come along with you on the journey of that story, however short or long it is, that's when those writing chops come into play, and being able to see that bigger story that you're viewing. I often think of obscure species as sort of a doorway into a larger concept, and your audience might not care about that limitation, but I think they care about whatever that bigger takeaway is.
I think that's so important. I really love that. Last year at SEJ, I think it was Michelle Nyhaus who was talking about one way to make a story engaging is to frame like your the animal, the ecosystem, the plant that you're talking about as like an individual, as a character, and like really thinking about it through that kind of more cinematic lens. And then you have this creature that has wants and a will to live and a family. And I think that like that is so can be really, really effective. But I'm also just curious, like given that experience that you have, like what are some of the other, I don't know, tips to make those stories feel like you're carrying the reader along with you on a story? Like are things that anything that comes to mind in terms of structuring the story or like where how to think about first person scenes, like what are some of the MFA things that you took away from that to apply here?
I know it's a big question. I'm in trouble with my traditional journalism because I do like having the first person even in reported stories because I think it's a way that you do your best to be an objective journalist, but at the end of the day, you are constrained by your own subjectivity. So I'm a big fan of like what I call the first person minor, which is it's not a personal essay, it's not about you, but somewhere along the way you acknowledge that you are there as an observer. You say, you know, I thought this or I realized this or whatever, just somewhere, you know, I'd say like, yeah, I am a fallible human also doing my best to understand this. But I think it's, again, getting back to those craft elements of, you know, your voice, your tone. Some people are extremely funny. Some people can do amazing scene and, like, give character to those species. Some people have a way of developing interesting protagonists in their sources and whatever those skill sets are for you to that. And thinking about, like, have in mind an audience. So for me, again, back in my affair, which feels like forever ago, it would be like, you know, the aunties in my family who, for the most part, very busy immigrant women who, like, were not going hiking, did not have a deep instilled concern about like nature, but like what I want to read, what they would still want to read. And like really busy people raising kids who like are really kind of interested in nature, but you know, it's not like an obsession for them. And so like have that audience in mind who's not an environmentalist, you know, in the traditional sense, or is not someone with a science background, and like would they find your writing interesting?
Not to throw another question your way, but I also just want to, like, we talked a lot about, you know, bringing the human connection element into the stories. That's like a really good way to make people care. And I really liked your point about using other lenses to look for stories other than like this Western scientific machine. What are some of your tips for like finding the human history behind certain places or species? Like what are your sources for that typically? Is it people? Is it like documents?
It's a mix. I definitely am one of those really among writers who like does deep dives and goes down deep rabbit holes on a topic, and it's like, okay, it's the words, can you please just write it? But it's a whole mix, and you know, if you are writing, so for that that chestnut story, There were a few books that had been written about the history of American chestnut, the environmental history of American chestnut, but I also relied a lot on the history from some of my indigenous sources for that story. And there are, you know, experts I talked to in genetic engineering or in the history of like East Coast forests who didn't necessarily get quoted in the story, but that was like part of my homework of like doing that background research and just constantly, you know, if you can think of the species as its own entity, then you can think of its full life history in a different way. So if I think of the American chestnut, like I was digging up research on, you know, when it first evolved and like what part of the planet that was, because I was thinking of it as its own thing from before we existed. And that got cut because the story was too long. But when you think of it separate from humans, you can think of its history as separate from humans up to a point as well, and then encompassing humans as well.
Right. And then Doug, like when you're writing a story about something that doesn't have a clear tie-in to people, like let's say, and I mean I like hate saying this, but like if there's like an instance where something is about to go extinct and it's like an invertebrate somewhere or like a reptile that people have never seen, like what do you do in those cases? Like we talked about some of the cinematic elements that can help, but when there really doesn't seem to be like an obvious like important role that it plays in the ecosystem, it's not something that people encounter, it like you're struggling to find like what makes it important to people, like what do you do in those cases when And like this brings up the question of like inherent value and how to communicate inherent value of something that doesn't have such a clear like why this is important part to it.
Right. I mean, I think in those cases, I was trying to think of some examples, but I think it's crucial to find people that care, you know, and the easiest way to do that is to find people that have researched them, you know, just searching for people who have published on X species. And it's fun to just like email people, authors, like a scientist who wrote a paper about something 10 years ago, and you really never know if you're going to get a response or not, but when you do, it can be absolutely golden. But oftentimes, you know, the people who study these things, they're just the best voice for why it matters, and they obviously care. A lot of scientists like devote their lives to studying some weird species or some weird biome. And that's honestly like the bedrock for me, probably in terms of like the importance and the human elements, yeah. Especially for a shorter story based on some finding or study. Like I'm thinking of like some cavefish species where it's like, they're very limited in scope and maybe they're threatened, and like, does anyone really care about cavefish? Like, actually, yes. And you should too. You know, like, I mean, I'm kind of kidding, but not really, because I think cavefish are cool. And
I love that. I think that is such a good tip, is just like, look to the people who are obsessed with whatever the animal or plant or the place is. And often they can be your central characters, and you can just use their words to describe why it's so important. And it also reminds me of a cave salamander story that I did. And it was amazing because it was like a longer story, and the main guy was like a spelunker and just incredible. And we never saw anything, but it was still like good because of his personality. So I think that's a really, really good tip. I also just think, like, Bethany, like when you talk about these animals, you are so passionate, and like that totally rubs off on everyone. And I think if you can bring that passion that you have into your pitch, into the story, like that does a lot of the work for you. So I love that. We have like 30 minutes left, so I want to open up to the audience for questions. Please just state your name and affiliation, and then I'll ask your question.
Really quick, can I add something?
Yes, please.
So you talked about inherent value. And said, well, you know, like if this animal is going extinct or this, you know, plant species, and like nobody knows what it does, and maybe nobody cares. And it's my inherent value, honestly. I don't really want to think too hard about that because it's dark. But like, you know, inherent value, we think of things in ecosystem services and in terms of our value to us or the value to the ecosystem. Like, let me eat a mosquito. Does it matter? right? Like, inherent value is a subjective judgment that we are passing on other things. And sometimes it's useful to point that out to people, to say, like, yeah, you are judging this thing, and I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying you're judging it.
Any questions from the audience here? Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Margo Starling, freelancer based in New York. Thank you all so much for this panel. This is very fun. My question is how you can make animals characters without anthropomorphizing to a fault or plants, because that's one of the things that I think both on like the journalism and the science side, we struggle with a little bit. But I'm also curious to know if any of you think that there is no such thing as anthropomorizing to a fault or what your views are on it. Benji, please feel free to chime in.
I love this question. Do you have thoughts on this? Like the line between... Yeah, talking about it scientifically versus anthropomorphizing. And when is that useful?
All right, you know I have thoughts. I know you have thoughts. So why don't you go?
Me?
Yes.
I mean, I don't see a problem. Like, I think that I see my job is bringing people into a story, and I'm not so worried, unless it's, like, a case where it's going to make someone go out and want to, like, touch wildlife. I think that it can be very, very useful. And it can help us connect to a species. But I really like the point that you made about like flipping that on its head and saying like, we don't need to always relate it to us. You can also say like, they think we're gross. And I think that's important too. But yeah, I don't know. I think like often it's very hard to do that. But I think ultimately you're reading it from such a human perspective and that is a way to pull someone in. So I don't really worry that much about that line.
I mean, I came from science and I actually came from behavior. So I studied neuroscience. And so I have like an inherent allergy to like over anthropomorphization of animals because you simply cannot say that a particular behavior means that an animal is thinking or feeling a particular thing. So I will relentlessly draw comparisons. I will absolutely draw comparisons. But I don't, I draw the line at, this animal is feeling this. This animal is thinking this. I will say the animal is behaving a way, but I won't say that. Because, and again, I mean, my main concern is, especially in writing my book, the number of people who honestly feel friend-shaped, why not friend, is really high and disturbing. Not friend, okay? The vast majority of the time, not friend. And people will just, you know, and the thing is, they'll be like, oh, but see, this particular mountain lion, it's so beautiful, and it's such a good mother, and it cares for its babies, and therefore it will not bite me on the back of my neck. never underestimate the desire for humans to cuddle things that should not be cuddled.
I think it's a complicated topic for sure. I think it's especially useful when you're trying to make people care for an animal, but in terms of like respecting their worth their right to exist. And I think when it becomes, in my opinion, when it becomes problematic is when we draw like societal comparisons. I think it's a lot. I think animals obviously have emotions and I think like any owner of a cat or dog knows that like, you know, animals have emotions. And some of these things I think like, we are kind of afraid to, we can be afraid, like from the science, like you were talking about, like the scientific point of view, we have to be very careful about saying what it is. But I think I'm more comfortable with that maybe than like a hard science person in terms of like things that are like what an animal seems to be feeling. But when it comes to, I mean, every animal is not human. Like there aren't, we're a species, right? And I think it's really important to try to take the point of view of the animal and not always make it about humans. I think when it's especially like problematic is when we try to make it societal, like compare it, like because societal things are so arbitrary. You know what I mean? Like there are all sorts of different human societies and gender roles, and when that stuff creeps in, it sort of weirds me out.
Gender and animal reporting. It's just nasty.
Gender is the Penguins Island. What was your beef with that?
Okay, so on TikTok, there's this aquarium that does Penguin Love Island every year during penguin season. That they have all the kids come to the aquarium and they paint rocks pretty colors, and then they present the rocks to the penguins. And of course, penguins, their courtship behavior involves the presentation of pretty rocks. And so, if I were a child and I painted a rock, and then like no penguin picked the rock. Oh my goodness, painful core memory. Even penguins hate my art. I think it's Penguin Love Island. I will say I watch every single video.
I'm like, that's great.
So you can't stop me. But it is, it's weird. Because like they'll say, oh my god, did you see that like Roxy and Skeeter, they've been together for like 2 years, but Roxy is bowing to Mr. Smith. And yes, oh my goodness, how dare you, Roxy? So I get that feeling. It rises in me immediately. But also I kind of want us to be more curious about it. Why might Roxy move? There might be some really important reasons, right? Are they genetic reasons? Are they behavioral reasons? You know, did her original mate switch deodorant? I mean, these all could be very valid. And so I feel like sometimes the anthropomorphization becomes too easy and kind of inspires people to be slightly less curious about the few things these animals could do in
life. I think there's also just a difference between making an animal an individual, a full being with all those things that come along with it, without just projecting our own lives onto them. And I think that, I don't know, that's something to think about too. Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think, I mean, actually speaking, it can depend on the outlet you're writing for and the assignment.
On the outlet.
Right, the outlet and the assignment. And if you're writing a short newsy explainer, that's one thing. If you're writing a personal essay about your interaction with something, like an octopus, say, people love covering that, that's another thing. And this sounds so simplistic, but I think at the basic level, like just verb choice, like, really sure to use active verbs even when you're talking about something that is not a human, and you're not necessarily projecting feelings, but if something creeps, it's creeping. That's like a weird choice. You could possibly say that something I can't even think of a good example. This is where active and passive verbs are. You could say it's migratory when shifted south, or you could say, the species began, flying this way, or making this choice, or doing this thing. And that's not necessarily anthropomorphizing, but it is allowing that other species have agency.
Yes.
Which is really interesting, I think, when you're writing about things that don't move very much, like plants, to find ways to still engage actively in the language. Something that I think you can also do, depending on what kind of story it is, again, if it's an essay, you can express your own curiosity, a personal example, I was writing a story about yucky catfish, and one of the reasons that they're extinct is because they're interbreeding with a really common other species of catfish that's been introduced to a range. But something was like, if they're so similar, they can interbreed, and like, why does it matter if they go extinct? And then I had this realization that I was like, I can't tell them apart without like genetic testing. But they can tell themselves, I know a catfish, and that's not that different from each other. They're totally different species, just like different species from other species. They can sense things about each other that I can't, and that's like a limit of my perception as a primate, not the lack of difference between them. So that's like an essayistic moment, right? I'm going to put that in a 600-word story about a catfish. The one thing I just wanted to say is, you also, of course, are going to be careful about extending metaphors too far and getting into judgments about, humans. Like, when survival of the fittest became a reason to commit some pretty atrocious, decisions about eugenics, right?
or, you know, when some language is used around non-native species now. And like, I studied invasion biology in college, and I understand why, like, invasive species can, like, ruin back ecosystems, but when people start using that same language around humans moving, like, then you've extended that approach too far. So that's something else to think about also. I just want to follow up. I really like your active voice for, like, thinking about migratory birds. Mm-hmm. And I feel like using active voice like that is especially important when thinking about kind of the consequences of climate change, because we so often see climate change and, like, all of the stuff that we have in the earth as us just, like, grinding the earth into dust, which, yes. But I also think it's really important to give the species agency in how they are reacting, right? And I like the use of the active voice help kind of give these animals agency, right? We are doing terrible things, but they are reacting. And I really, that's an important thing to emphasize when we're talking about impacts of climate change.
And some of them are winning. They're being very, they're really successful. Other questions?
Hi, everyone. My name is Khadija. And I kind of had a question about what happens after your work is published. So you guys spend your time and energy writing about plants and animal species that people don't necessarily care about. So I wanted to ask, what is it that you guys want or hope for readers to take away from your work, or, like, do after reading your work? Both the people who care about these animals and species, and for those who really don't. Like, these are people like you guys.
Do everyone have a question?
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah. It was basically, what do you hope readers will take away from your work, whether the interested in the species or maybe just learning about it? Is that, yeah. I think it was a great question. Like, what do we feel like our responsibility is here?
That's right. No, I hope that people will, for my book in particular, I want people to not just go with their guts when they see an animal. Because often when they see animals, especially animals we hate, the gut response just takes over. And I really want people to stop and be like, why am I being like this? And have curiosity, because that curiosity is what opens people up to learning about the species around them, which is way more effective in terms of mitigation than simply trying to poison your way out of problem.
Yeah, to piggyback off that, I think... ideally, if a reader sees a species in a different light, hopefully a more enlightened or understanding place, a more open-minded place. I think that is one of the main goals. One of my big things, I really dislike the tendency to be afraid of insects and spiders, for example. And it's, yeah, you know, like the vast majority of insects and spiders are harmless and in fact helpful. And especially, yeah. So I mean, I wrote a story kind of looking at for Nat Geo about, like, looking at why people are so afraid of insects when it's the vast majority of the time, like, completely needless and harmful. It can lead to, you know, crazy use of toxic insecticides and that kind of thing. And a lot of these things are pollinators and really helpful. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, people living in cities, more people live in cities now than in rural areas. And so the insects they're exposed to are often pests, but you know, the vast majority of insects are not. And so that is kind of a huge thing for me.
And just on the insect and, like, spider stories, like, I also think I think it's important to meet readers where they're at and be like, okay, people are going to come into this with, like, the feeling that they're icky, but then you can kind of, like, Trojan horse in the, like, actually there's lots of reasons to respect these creatures. And I like to do that is, like, I'll frame it as, like, oh no, like, I get to read what I already know. And then it's like, yeah.
I also want people to reframe their emotions, because often when we see animals, especially animals that we deem pests, they tend to kind of jump out at us, right? Like, we're not expecting them, and we're shocked, and we feel vulnerable. But being human, the first thing we do after feeling vulnerable is kill it. And so I would love if we sat with our shock for a minute, because I feel like that's a lot of the issue with a lot of insects, right? We're surprised, we're shocked. And then if you sit with that surprise for a second, you can be like, okay, yeah, all right, yeah. You know, so I think that can also help.
kind of reframe that, is encourage people to kind of sit with their surprise instead of immediately trying to get rid of the thing that surprised them.
Yeah, be curious. And so be curious and to just be distinguishing, because when you're afraid, it like shuts down that. And it's kind of amazing how much it can affect people. Like that, as an example, so the giant hornet Vespa mandarinia showed up in one county in Northwest Washington. This was like just after the start of the pandemic. And so the whole murder hornet like fear began. And I mean, they're definitely like, they're definitely a species that can hurt you, and they will be bad for beekeepers because they eat bees. They decapitate bees and then feed the bodies to the chew the bodies to their young. Anyway, the point is, that makes people interested.
Feed your kids chicken nuggets. I'm just saying.
But I was amazed. I covered that pretty extensively for Nat Geo, and like I was amazed at how people around the country were like suddenly seeing murder hornets, you know. And I never want to be like a know-it-all kind of guy, but I'm like, you're not seeing murder hornets in Florida. Like, you're just not. There are a lot of other things that look like that to the untrained eye, but you know, like, be curious, maybe learn. If it could, like, spur people to learn about their native hornets, like, that would be awesome. And, yeah, so that is, like, part of that's my secret agenda.
I also have a secret agenda. I feel like, as journalists, we're constantly, you know, we want to report the truth, and we want to tell the truth. And the truth can be really politicized. And I think because I have a background in ecology, I often see organisms, and human organisms, as like evidence of histories that may not be taught or talked about very much. And so if somebody reads something, even if it's like a short little piece about salmon that I read earlier this year, I pack in as much of that history as possible, and not just the what, the how, but the why. And I hope that people will read that story. First of all, I haven't enjoyed reading it. It wasn't like a slog to read. And also just like curious in a different way about some kind of received knowledge that they had previously had.
Thank you for the question.
I'm probably Bloomberg News. As freelancers, how do you find editor interest in general publications in wildlife stories, in animal stories? Is it an ebb and flow?
I wonder if you could repeat the question.
The question was about how to get editor interest.
I just wondering, how do you find editor interest? How are they interested in animals in general?
Puns also.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about finding editors that are interested. I mean, not to say the obvious, but editors that are interested in that kind of thing, just having relationships with people is pretty crucial, and it helps learn it. I mean, once you have a working relationship, you have a feeling for like what they're probably interested in. But yeah, I mean, oftentimes things I'm pitching, I'm kind of new to freelancing, and especially to start out, I'm doing more like shorter stories, like based on studies, and you know, leading with the surprising finding, and so something that is, yeah, like new, never seen before, whatever. That I think that really helps. I mean, it's not the hardest sell, you know. Honestly, it's harder to sell some like environmental health stories sometimes, or yeah, it relationships and like amping up what is cool about it.
I think I might have less experience freelancing, but I tend to, well, first of all, if folks are not familiar with the Open Notebooks, the website and has a whole bunch of pitches that were accepted that people share there. So if you want examples of pitches to look at when you're thinking about a particular outlet, or just how to structure your pitch, check out the Open Notebooks website and the pitch library, because it's pretty awesome. But yeah, I tend to try to cultivate relationships with editors who are at places where I like the work that they've published, and think that I do work that they'd be interested in. And I think of those pitch emails as like the start of a conversation. And I've worked on the editorial side as well. So I've received pitches, and I just think of it as a conversation and trying to figure out, like, what does this editor want? And is that something that I'm able to produce, interested in producing?
I think, like, when we, I mean, I will look at pitches a fair amount, and they, the things that we look for, I mean, the number one is just, like, doesn't really matter how narrow the topic is, if they can zoom out in some way pretty quickly in the pitch, like make the stakes very, very clear right away. So it's maybe one animal telling a much, much bigger story. And I also just think there's, like, we think about stories like either as, I mean, hopefully these are both true, but like it's an important story that might not garner like a huge amount of attention, or it's a story like, or we just say, okay, like there's going to be a lot of interest in this. So like, I don't know, we kind of look through those two different lenses. That's like, of course, distillation, but in general.
Yeah, there's so many big environmental stories.
Sorry, can you say your name?
My name is Olivia Heeger, and I'm a student at NYU Sherb. And I'm curious if you can even kind of make the case for like why wildlife and why plants, when there are so many like big, like serious environmental stories with oil and climate refugees. Sometimes reporting on plants and animals can feel so small and silly, but I believe there is a case for it and a place for it. And I'm wondering if each of you could just make a case for like why wildlife in the face of all these scary, massive things.
So like with all these other crises going on around the world, including climate change, et cetera, big oil, gas, like why wildlife and plants?
Can't witness forever. And as journalists in particular, we spend a lot of time witnessing, bearing witness. And if everything we're witnessing is terrible, then all of a sudden your perspective is gone. And there is no joy. Joy is way more motivating than misery in your personal experience. And like, maybe that's just me. But I think there's a balance to be had between the really dark, terrible, important things that we need to report on and we need to witness. And also the joy that we can inspire and share, because it's so much easier to want to kind of be there for the natural world when you realize it's awesome, you know?
I also think like those other crises, they're all connected, right? Like we can talk about the ways that climate change is affecting animals, how they're coping with it. And I think some people might want an entree into a topic through animals, but then can learn about climate change, whether it's because it's like making animals smaller or whatever. So I think like it's important to always think about these problems from like an intersectional lens as well.
Actually, I just wanted to add to that. I ended up writing a big feature for Good Housekeeping like 2 years ago now. And they came to me and they were like, hey, what's an animal story that can make people care about climate change? And I said, okay, do you hate yellow jackets? And they're like, yes. I was like, well. And I ended up writing a feature about why you shouldn't hate yellow jackets, but also yellow jackets are expensive for climate change.
I also think just like biodiversity loss might not seem like it's on the scale of some of these other problems, but I think there's an argument to be made that it very much is. And so I think it, when I think about our role here, it's like elevating these problems to that level, because I think they matter so much more than people realize.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a good question. I've asked myself that before. But I think, honestly, it's all that stuff happening. It's even more important than ever to be celebrating the biodiversity, talking about the extinction crisis. I've for most of my career been more focused on like extinction and biodiversity loss. I think that is one of the worst things happening on the planet, and it's like it's all connected, right? So like I think it's more important than ever to answer your question. But to me, it doesn't seem like an aside at all. It is one of the crucial things, and the disconnection between humans and our environment and plants and animals in the environment, like that disconnection is a huge part of what's driving the problem. So, you know, if you can help people be interested in the natural world and know about it, like that's a motivating factor for me. Like, that's why I do this.
I really appreciate that question. And I think about that a lot. And one thing that I say is that, I do care about like human well-being first. Like if I could save the last of a rare species or a person, I would absolutely save that person, like no question. But I also think sometimes there's a false dichotomy where when you look at what's causing the climate crisis and a lot of our environmental issues these days, it's the same things that are like harming human species, human communities, and harming other species, and like non-humans. And it's the same power structures, it's the same system of policies, it's the same like globalization of capitalism. And so I think being able to make those connections is also really valuable.
So I want to ask about sort of say your name I want to ask about the other side of this question, which is about obscure ecosystems. Because at least in my experience, sometimes it's the flip side of the problem. Well, like recently I've been thinking about like mountain ecosystems and tropical dry forests, which are really important for that specific way. And I've sort of just been kind of hoping that maybe a way to talk about these things comes across something that is like timely and you know, curious enough or cool enough or like even just weird enough that I'd be able to pitch a story about these things. So when we're thinking about like the other side of it, which is like, all right, there's this ecosystem. How do I get in? How do I humanize it? How do I make it tangible? How do I find and pitch a story about like not just like one animal or one specific species, but like a system and why it's important and why people should care?
It comes back a little bit to like the human histories and thinking about like what experiences people have had in that place. I think that's also a good opportunity to enlist like a first person so you can describe what you're seeing and how you're feeling in that environment. And then also just like how connected it is to other parts of that region. I don't know, all those things I think can be helpful.
To me, that's the stage of like, I have a topic, but not a story. And that's when I encourage you to like go down that rabbit hole of research, maybe not all the way down the rabbit hole, but just do a lot of research until the story emerges.
Yeah. And within the ecosystem, I mean, like Maya was saying, I mean, I think like as an example, both of us care a lot about the borderlands. And oh my gosh, so that's something that, yeah, I mean, I care about and have followed. And like, I would say if you get deep into it, like you won't just have one story, you'll have like a career of stories, you know? And yeah, so like finding the stories, the topic can help drive stories, but I think just more reporting and staying on something will be very fruitful.
Yeah, I would say you have, I hate that I'm drawing human metaphor here, but we're doing it. The ecosystem, you have the house, find who lives in it.
Oh, very simple. I love it. The lady in the back, one more question here.
Oh, thank you. I'm Susan Jewell, freelance writer and recently retired invasive wildlife biologist. So I guess I'm having a little trouble trying to figure out how to phrase my question, but my question is for Bethany. Your two examples of, you know, obscure were both species that are not native to the Western Hemisphere. And you're trying to point out all the benefits and good aspects of them. Do you ever talk about how they're not native to this hemisphere and the harms that they cause?
So the question is, do I ever talk about the harms that non-native species cause? Oh, ask the people who are screaming at me about writing about these on the internet. Yes. Because I was not sufficiently nice about the ponies. You have to be real nice about ponies. No, I mean, I think it's important to bring those things up, and I absolutely do try to bring those things up. But I think also it's very important to keep perspective on a lot of these animals that we deem invasive, right? Because the reality is they're invasive because we brought them here, right? It's not their fault they are where they are. That's us. And so I think it's important to kind of keep that perspective when we approach it, because so often when we start talking about invasive and we start talking about pests, it becomes what one philosopher described to me as epistemological violence, which is basically the license to do whatever you want to it. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to think before we do that. Right? There are some non-native species that are now integrating into ecosystems in various ways. There are some that are not. There are some that I know several indigenous communities have added to their foodways. There are some that are not. So I think it's just important to consider each ecosystem and each species that happens to be present there very much separately and as a part of where they are, as opposed to as a blanket statement of what they are.
Thank you guys all. I think we're out of time. We can try to like hang out outside if you guys have some more questions, but I just want to say thank you again to our amazing panelists, and thank you all for your questions and for being here. This was a lot of fun.